trip to West Africa was a visit to open a school in a small village a few hours outside of Abidjan, the relatively affluent capital of the Ivory Coast. Accompanied by a young couple from the U.S. Embassy, we were welcomed by most of the village, led by a chief in robes and derby hat, despite the 105-degree heat and oppressive humidity. At an outdoor banquet, he made a speech in French, declaring what an honor it was to have me there as the 17th most important person in the world, a description he had obviously picked up from a poll that had appeared in U.S. News and World Report. From then on, Jim Hoagland enjoyed referring to me as Numéro 17. In 1980, I scheduled a trip to the Middle East with Meg and Jim to include, at Henry Kissinger's suggestion, Saudi Arabia as well as Egypt and Israel. We were not sure the Saudis would receive two women, but embassy officials, and more important, Prince Bandar, an influential member of the royal family then in this country training with the Army Air Force, told us we would be welcome. Meg and I had been so thoroughly briefed about how to dress and how generally to comport ourselves while in Saudi Arabia that we were in a state of mild terror as we landed. But we were told that our even being allowed to disembark from the front of the plane represented real progress. Only a few years previously, Pat Nixon and Nancy Kissinger had had to exit through a door at the back of the plane. Women were simply invisible in Saudi Arabia. We saw them only once during our visit, at the house of Sheikh Ahmed Zaki Yamani, then Minister of Petroleum and Mineral Resources, where he had assembled a small group of very westernized technicians, middle managers in government, and their wives. By contrast, a dinner at the home of Prince Abdullah, then the third most powerful man in the country and the head of its National Guard, turned out to be something out of the 1001 Arabian Nights. We drove up to his palace, Meg and I dressed demurely in long skirts and long-sleeved blouses, covering everything we possibly could, and stepped into a large oval room around the walls of which members of the guard sat cross-legged, with full military regalia over their Arab robes, leather straps lined with bullets crossed over their chests. They stared at us as we were led to seats elevated above theirs, but surrounding a kind of throne that was positioned even higher than ours, in which sat Prince Abdullah. We learned later that Abdullah had had to explain to his men for an hour beforehand why he had to have these two American women to dinner. In Egypt, we interviewed President Sadat at his country home. We had several small tape recorders going as he talked, the Egyptians a single large one. We were impressed to see a man emerge as if by magic from behind the bushes in the garden to change the tape. Sadat kept addressing me personally, with brutally offensive remarks about some of his neighbors. He would say, "Jimmy," referring to Carter, "told me I can't say this, Catherine, of King Hussein," and then he would go on to make some derisive and cutting remark. He also had some biting things to say about Henry Kissinger. But it was an interesting interview, and everyone went straight to work writing it up for the Post and Newsweek. We were amused when an Egyptian government man appeared, somewhat embarrassed, to ask us for a copy of our tapes from the interview, since their recorder hadn't worked. Later, we were dumbstruck to discover that, whereas we had observed their ground rules and had omitted all the startling remarks Sadat had made, the transcript of the interview ran in its entirety in an Egyptian paper, complete with the acerbic asides addressed to me. I hate to think of the repercussions these may have caused. While we were in Egypt, I asked to see the Shah of Iran, to whom the Egyptians had given refuge, and at the last minute they agreed to allow Jim and me in. The Shah was perfectly willing, even eager, to talk at length and on the record, and indeed he spoke for 2 hours, flaying the British and the Americans for turning their backs on him. He regretted, as Jim noted in the lead to his story, having followed a policy of surrender to his opponents during his final days in power, and said he wished he had used military force to put down the demonstrations that broke his rule. He told us that it was his own miscalculations, coupled with conflicting signals from the American and British governments, that had caused him to fail. Our interview with the Shah turned out to be his final one, since he died shortly thereafter. In Israel, nothing equaled our last dinner there, which was hosted by the Director General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, a dinner that degenerated into a savage attack on the Post in general and its editorial policy in particular. At one point, Meg spoke up to rebut these attacks, saying that the Israelis needed to understand that one couldn't help being humbled by all that the Jews had experienced in Europe and by the danger they were in now, and that nobody she knew thought otherwise. But what we were writing was our idea of what had to be done to avoid a terrible fate. With that, the questions began and grew increasingly hostile. The Israelis were especially vicious to Meg, who, being Jewish, was someone they thought ought to espouse their views uncritically. One of the most bizarre of the interviews we held during these trips was with Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. Jim Hoagland, Chris Dickey of Newsweek, and I had gone to North Africa in 1988 to take a closer look at the growth of fundamentalism there. We succeeded in a last-minute request to interview Gaddafi, who was in Algeria at the time, with the leaders of that country and Tunisia, and we were flown to where the leaders were meeting and where we were to see Gaddafi. We were all startled to be told that he wanted to see me alone first, but I walked into our agreed-upon meeting place, and Gaddafi received me in a small room, rising from a leather chair to greet me politely. We exchanged small talk, and then he quickly led the discussion to Bob Woodward's book on the CIA, Veil, which had just come out, and in which Bob had reported on the CIA's having collected information about certain of Gaddafi's proclivities, alleging that he had been known to wear makeup and high-heeled shoes, and that his aides had bought a toy teddy bear for him. Gaddafi, like everyone else, was concerned about what had been written about him. What I particularly noticed was his eyes. They never stopped rolling around, looking everywhere but straight at you. He used an interpreter, but seemed to know a lot of English, and occasionally even corrected the interpreter's attempt to soften his language. My meeting with Gaddafi went on long enough so that Jim got edgy, and finally he and Chris decided to interrupt. When the interview was over, I asked if I could take Gaddafi's picture. When he agreed, my camera inconveniently jammed. I was so frustrated that I gave it a powerful hit, and it somehow worked. I got a sufficiently good photo so that Newsweek used it in a story and gave me a credit as a freelancer, as well as a check for $87.50, which I framed. Probably the most demanding interview on all our trips was the one we did with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev later that year. Jim and I had been working on setting up an interview with the Soviet president for about 5 years and through three different presidents. Chernenko had agreed, but was taken ill and died. Andropov had then given us hope of an interview when he too got sick and died. When Gorbachev came along, I immediately started again and was frustrated when both Tom Brokaw of NBC and Time magazine preceded us. Finally, just before a summit meeting with President Reagan, an interview in Moscow was granted, and we worked terribly hard preparing for it, right up to the last minute. When we went into the meeting room, Gorbachev came on in his usual strong, charismatic way, but as soon as we sat down and began asking questions, there was a noticeable change in his manner. He was no less articulate than he had been when I'd met him at official functions in Washington, but he seemed strangely subdued in voice and demeanor, even laid back in the physical sense. However, he started sitting upright and tensing up as the questions grew distasteful to him, reacting almost physically to questions about possible dissension in the Politburo and the jailing of vocal dissidents. Nevertheless, he answered at length in a very controlled fashion, until he cut off the interview abruptly after the fifth question, which was about human rights. So nervous was Gorbachev about any hint of dissension in the Central Committee that he had Nikolai Shishlin, an important Central Committee official, call the Post's Moscow bureau to pass on the message that he didn't want to be quoted as mentioning the names of anyone from the Politburo. Bob Kaiser took the call from Shishlin, who also said that since President Gorbachev didn't want any Politburo person named in the transcript of questions that had been asked, we would have to reformulate one of the questions that had specifically referred to Yegor Ligachev, a conservative anti-reformer and Gorbachev's reputed chief rival at the time. Shishlin told Kaiser, "Let's play this by Moscow rules." Kaiser's response was that, since he was asking us to use the Soviet's official transcript of the interview rather than our own, only I could make that decision. After we insisted that it was impossible for us to delete Ligachev's name from the interview, Shishlin called the Bureau again to say that Gorbachev himself wanted Georgi Arbatov, the Soviet Union's foremost Americanologist, to deliver a message to me. Arbatov found me in the apartment of Gary Lee, the Post's Moscow correspondent, where several of us had gathered, and he and I went into a separate room so that he could talk with me alone. He argued hard that we owed this small favor to Gorbachev, who had granted me the big favor of the interview. I said I was sorry, but this was not a favor within my power to grant. Once we had asked a question, it was unthinkable to go back and edit the question. We wouldn't even do this for our own president, much less another country's. I held firm. After a while, we joined the others, and when he rose to leave, Shishlin, who had accompanied Arbatov, looked at me and said, "Don't worry, you won't be arrested." We never learned why Gorbachev was so sensitive about having Ligachev's name mentioned, and soon thereafter, as Bob Kaiser pointed out, Gorbachev willingly answered a question about his relations with Ligachev with no sign of sensitivity. The Gorbachev interview was in some ways the cap of all these trips with Meg and Jim and others, which were such an important part of my life for 15 years or more. We logged tens of thousands of miles over the years in traveling to South Africa, the Philippines, China, Korea, Japan, India, and countries throughout the Middle East and South America. Although Don was the publisher of the Post and editorially responsible for the paper, with his encouragement, I stayed involved in ways that never interfered with his authority. These trips were one way. Receiving certain foreign visitors was another. Often people I had met abroad came to Washington, and I would invite them to the Post for editorial lunches. I also often entertained people at my house. For the most part, I didn't give public dinners just for the sake of giving them. They almost always served some purpose. Frequently, the guests of honor were people we had met on our editorial trips. Both President Kaunda of Zambia and President Mugabe of Zimbabwe came when they were in Washington, as did Willy Brandt, Vaclav Havel, and Helen Suzman. Occasionally, because I had the room and the facilities to accommodate sizable groups, and because I had the staff to bring an event together without too much effort, I was asked by go-betweens to entertain prominent visitors. This was the case with President Febres Cordero of Ecuador and with the King and Queen of Jordan. I was happy to do it, though somewhat to my dismay, I began to see myself mentioned in the press as a prominent Washington hostess, a term I very much disliked. Again, it seemed to me a sexist way of viewing what I was doing, which to me was a natural part of my job. I also felt strongly that it was part of my job to keep up with people in and out of office. It was all in my day's work to get to know those in government and help them know journalists. Many of my dinners involved members of various administrations over the years and could be described as political, although they were always nonpartisan, or at least bipartisan. I have been friends with presidents from both political parties, but any relationship, even an old one, can grow strained when you become, as I did, a symbol of a major newspaper and magazine and the target of presidential displeasure. This occurred with Johnson, Nixon, and Bush, but, curiously, not much with Reagan. Ford was professionally friendly. Except for entertaining the Clintons on Martha's Vineyard when they were there on vacation, I have had little contact with them. They have been polite, but are of a younger generation, so it's perfectly natural. Those who come to Washington as president and who haven't lived here and known the city, as had, for example, Jack Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and even Richard Nixon, seem to have a skewed idea of socializing between people from the press and people from the administration. There are those in both groups who feel that we shouldn't see each other except in working situations. Though I recognize that this issue of friendships or relationships is a touchy one, I take a different view. A hands-off approach may be best for those who are covering people in the government, but for a publisher, I feel sure openness is best. I consider it the role of the head of a newspaper to be bipartisan and to bring journalists together with people from government. I think that an easy relationship is constructive and useful for both sides. It helps the publication by opening doors and provides those who are covered in the news with the knowledge of whom they can suggest ideas to, complain to, or generally deal with. When people don't feel easy enough to call, they just sit there grinding their teeth. I fear unspoken anger. Especially, people who may disagree on politics must still be able to communicate, and it's crucial for all of us in the press to listen to all sides. Jimmy Carter was one of those outsider presidents who found it difficult to find the right modus operandi for Washington. One spring night, just a year into Carter's presidency, Ben Bradley and I gave a reception for the American Society of Newspaper Editors, which was meeting in Washington. There must have been 36 or so editors from all over the country, so I tried very hard to round up members of the government and people from the White House to meet them. Hamilton Jerdan, Carter's chief of staff, sent a polite but firm regret. Incredibly, I never even received an answer from the press secretary, Jody Powell. Thinking how stupid it was for the press secretary to ignore an event involving so many top editors, I called his office and asked to speak to him. I was told he was in a meeting. I explained about the party and that I felt it would be useful for him to attend. Still no answer, and he didn't come. Some years later, after Carter had left office, another such party took place. Powell was present, and he and his wife Nan were charming. In fact, he brought a harmonica and danced and sang late into the evening. Later, too, I got to know Hamilton Jerdan, and his ability and his charm were evident. I gave a dinner for him, at which my toast began, "Hamilton, welcome to the establishment." He replied that if he had joined earlier, Jimmy Carter might still be in the White House. I don't know that that's true, but I do believe that the Carter administration missed some good opportunities. With all of Carter's troubles both inside and outside Washington during his presidency, it was no surprise when Ronald Reagan defeated him to become the 40th president of the United States. I had met the Reagans several years before they came to Washington as president and first lady. Truman Capote told me he had gotten to know them in the course of some research he was doing on death sentences, in which he had become interested after writing In Cold Blood. "Honey, I know you won't believe me, but you'd really like them," Truman told me in his falsetto voice. Truman was right. We got along well and began a long friendship that puzzled many people in Washington. When the Reagans first came to Washington after the election, they gave a dinner for Washingtonians who were active in one way or another. I was unable to accept because of an out-of-town speech, but decided to invite them in return and was delighted when they accepted. Shaping a dinner for a president is tricky. There is a delicate line to be drawn as one tries to center it on them, to give them a good time, and in a sense, to ignore all else, including hurt feelings and pressure from people who would like to be there or think they should be there. The night the Reagans arrived for the dinner, my two wonderful longtime maids, Lucy and Dora, were leaning out a second-floor window, watching the limousine pull up. They saw President-elect Reagan step out and embrace me, kissing me on both cheeks. Dora, a forceful and funny woman, turned to Lucy and said, "I hope she enjoyed that, because that's the last time that will ever happen." Dora was wise in the ways of Washington, and ordinarily right, but in this instance she was wrong. In our toasts at that first dinner, we spoke about the advantages of knowing each other, which both the president-elect and I firmly believed in. For Reagan, however, there were repercussions from coming to dinner at my house. The political right was appalled. One newspaper featured a photograph of him embracing me, which the Wall Street Journal called a photograph that may upset arch conservatives almost as much as the famous one of Jimmy Carter bussing Leonid Brezhnev at the Vienna summit. Howard Phillips, head of the conservative caucus, lit into Reagan in remarks at the religious roundtable, saying, "You cannot always have Kay Graham going to your cocktail parties and smiling at you. If by June the Washington establishment is happy with Ronald Reagan, then you should be unhappy with Ronald Reagan." With some ups and downs, we managed to remain friends throughout the 8 years of Reagan's administration. At some point, Nancy and I started lunching together regularly. At first, just the two of us would have long, gossipy lunches. Later, Meg joined us, either at my house or hers. Probably the most public time Nancy and I had was a weekend she spent with me on the vineyard in August 1985. I couldn't imagine Nancy on the liberal and distinctly unchic vineyard, and thought Mike Deaver was mad to suggest such a thing. But when I invited her, she said yes right away, and she came, along with the Deavers and Meg and Warren. It was a typical vineyard weekend, very informal, with walks on the beach and casual dinners. I think Nancy enjoyed it, and I know I did, despite the solid week of work and planning. Our last dinner at my house was in November, after the election, in 1988, just as the Reagans were getting ready to leave Washington for California. Security surrounding the president had gotten much tighter. Although my door sits way back from the street, I was asked to put up a tent so that the president could get out of his car concealed from view. When I brought them in, I was told not to take them into the living room, because by then it was too crowded, but I simply ignored this and did so, and they were both quickly surrounded by well-wishing friends. The throng created one minor problem when someone knocked against a glass, which spilled a drink with ice onto the floor. I was dumbstruck at seeing the President of the United States down on his hands and knees in the middle of the crowd, picking up the ice. On the phone the next day, Nancy told me this reminded her of something that had happened in the hospital after the assassination attempt. The president, who was not supposed to get out of bed, went to the bathroom and spilled some water on the floor in the process. When attendants came in, he was on his hands and knees, wiping it up. Asked why, he said he was afraid the nurse would get into trouble. The natural arm's-length relationship between the government and the press always takes on an even more adversarial nature during any presidential campaign. The election year of 1988 was no exception. There were the usual stresses and strains with both Bush and Michael Dukakis, his Democratic opponent, and there were some unusual ones. Both candidates, of course, complained about our coverage of their campaigns. Both visited the paper for editorial lunches, but our troubles with each of them mounted sharply, as did our editorial dismay at their campaigns. I had known George Bush for years, not intimately, but pleasantly. My father had invested in the oil company Bush had started as a young man, and I liked both George and Barbara, and thought of them as fine, moderate Republicans in the tradition of his father, Senator Prescott Bush, whom I had also known. I hadn't seen much of them in the previous 8 years, when he had served as vice president, but was well aware that he had been loyal to Reagan, politically as well as personally. Newsweek, however, had gotten on the wrong side of the candidate when it published, the very week Bush had announced his intention to run for president, a cover story on the vice president titled "Fighting the Wimp Factor." The wimp label had been a thorn in the Bush campaign flesh since that time. The profile of Bush had been fair and complete, but the effect of the word wimp crying out from the cover on newsstands everywhere was hard to overcome. What followed was not untypical. The Bush people distanced themselves from Newsweek reporters. Finally, in September 1988, a meeting was set up at the vice president's residence between Rick Smith, Evan Thomas, and me from Newsweek, and Bush, Jim Baker, and Craig Fuller, Bush's chief of staff. Bush claimed that the whole story had been wildly distorted by playing up the word on the cover, for which he accurately blamed the editors. His family, whom he'd asked to cooperate on the story, was naturally upset and angry, and had advised him that further cooperation with the magazine in any but a technically correct manner would only prove the point that he was indeed a wimp. I earnestly tried to explain about the complicated Newsweekly process until Bush, without relenting, said that Rick Smith and Jim Baker should talk. As the vice president and I walked toward the door, he whispered to me in the nicest possible way, "We'll work it out, but don't tell them." Rick did get together with Baker and managed to clear the air enough so that we could do the necessary background reporting, but the issue never really died and was compounded by others. We, that is, reporters and editors from both the Post and Newsweek, had, of course, also met with Dukakis. Throughout the winter and spring, he had made a poor impression in several areas, but especially in national security policy. His campaign manager called me late in the campaign and said the candidate would like to meet with several of us informally. I went with a group from the Post and Newsweek, hoping we would see a side of Dukakis we hadn't seen before and get to know him a little as an individual. We all sat around his hotel room, and he talked, but nothing new was said, and nothing personal about his views was revealed. Despite his campaign, which I disliked, I voted for Bush. I thought Dukakis too inexperienced to govern. It was my only Republican vote for president. After Bush was elected, our relations were unexpectedly cool, if not hostile, throughout the 4 years of his administration. I rarely saw him and Barbara, except occasionally in long receiving lines. Perhaps my amicable relations with the Reagans and with George Shultz, for whom the Bushes had no love, compounded our problems. These cool or antagonistic relationships are part of life in Washington and are accepted as such, but I often think how self-defeating they are and how much better polite professional relations would serve political figures and journalists in situations like this. I agreed with a charming message I got from George McGovern after he had been defeated for the presidency. He recalled making some bitter remarks about a couple of our columnists at a dinner party, but wrote me, "I have regretted that outburst, and I have also established that the maximum time I can carry a grudge is about 3 months. This note is simply to say that I have now forgotten all campaign grudges. It is just too difficult trying to remember which people I'm supposed to shun." With rare exceptions, I feel strongly that McGovern's rule is an appropriate one for all of us. The longer I live, the more I observe that carrying around anger is most debilitating to the person who bears it. In the immediate years following Phil's death, it was terribly difficult for me to separate my work life from my private life. They were clearly so intermingled. For years, I had been on a kind of automatic pilot, trying to give attention to so many aspects of life at once, with 2 children still at home in the first years, friends, business acquaintances, always too much work, too many meetings, too many dinner parties. Fortunately, somewhere along the line, perhaps with the help of lessons learned from the women's movement, I began to have a happier time in my private life. Family and friends have always been vital to me, but at some point I started to enjoy other people as well, to connect more, even to appreciate male friends more. There were always men in my life, romances and close friends, and I enjoyed them all. As long as Phil was alive, I so adored him that I never thought about another relationship. In truth, that one-man-woman thinking stayed with me for years, and vestiges are there still. I have often been asked why I never remarried. In my early years at work, I resented the question, which I felt would not be asked of a male publisher. I usually answered that I really didn't know why. I still don't know all the reasons, but what I came to understand was that my job made it difficult, if not impossible. Men who appeal to me are strong, bright, tough, and involved. But that kind of man would probably not accept my own active and absorbing life. Those men need more attention and emotional energy than I had left over at the end of any working day, and I wasn't looking for a prince consort. In fact, I wasn't looking at all. Because I was so engrossed in what I was doing, I rarely gave a thought to possible remarriage. When I did think of it, it occurred to me that, although the idea had some appeal, it would almost surely never happen. When you've lived alone for a number of years, I'm afraid that you begin to realize how hard it would be to accommodate to living with someone else, adjusting to or even indulging his desires and his life. It was clear to me that I was married to my job, and that I loved it. When marriage works, and it does take a lot of work, it's the best way to live. I enjoy being around married people who really love each other, are constantly polite and caring about each other, and between whom you feel a real and supportive relationship. Henry and Nancy Kissinger are examples for me of two people who are very much in love with each other. Henry teases, complains, whines at this or that, but he once told me he couldn't exist without Nancy. Scotty and Sally Reston had a model marriage for nearly 50 years. I loved watching them together and understood how much they meant to each other. Scotty wrote me once, "I cannot imagine how I could have endured these years without Sally, and do not know how you have borne them without your Guy." What I believe to be true is that I couldn't have borne the dreariness of life without Phil had my life remained the one I had before he died. But mine was a changed life, and I couldn't imagine a new marriage working for me once I took over the post company. Being single poses some difficulties, however, especially for weekends in the country, vacations, and summers, moments when two people together do much better. After a while, I knew I had to figure out some way to spend these times alone or with my family. Buying a house on Martha's Vineyard was a step that altered my life very much for the better and added greatly to my happiness. When I first found the house, it was completely tumble down, having been rented by people who basically camped in it. But I loved its shape and the way it sat on the beautiful land. From my first look at it, I began to imagine that the house could become a family center if the children liked it, or they could leave grandchildren with me if they wanted to travel. Since I bought it in 1972 and renovated it the following year, I have spent every August there, and my children and grandchildren love it as much as I do. My stays there always restore me. So the vineyard helped my summers, and my friends helped throughout the year. The lives of those of us who stay on in Washington change somewhat with a change of administrations, but our core friendships remain pretty much the same. There is a saying about relationships in Washington: if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. Maybe because I've always lived here, because this is in a very real sense my hometown, I've found that not to be at all true. I'm sure it's different if you arrive here as a member of a new administration. It always takes a while to make new friends in a strange town. And undoubtedly there will be people who try to wangle friendships with those in power in order to use them for one reason or another. Jim Jones, a congressman who had been defeated for election to the Senate in 1986 and is now our ambassador to Mexico, was quoted as saying he had learned during his tenure here about friends and friends of convenience. But I see nothing wrong with the fact that people in power often deal with others on more than one level. Sometimes you become friends with people with whom you work because of some common interest or just because you have to work together. But there are also relationships that start out that way, yet cross over to become real friendships that last forever. Some of my deepest friendships began with an administration person whom I got to know because of my association with the paper. Bob McNamara and Henry Kissinger come immediately to mind, but grew over time into relationships whose core had nothing to do with politics or work. This is true of others as well. Paul Nitze, Douglas Dillon, Mac Bundy, Jack Valenti, Joe Califano, Larry Eagleburger. In business, the same is true for my relationship with Ed Nay, whom I met because he was head of Young and Rubicam, but with whom I have maintained a friendship. What began as another business relationship with the head of the Hecht Company, Alan Bluestein, also developed into something beyond that for me. George Shultz and I had been friends when he was in Nixon's cabinet, and he was one of the few administration officials who remained friends with me through Watergate. I admired and liked him. We re-met at dinner at Meg's house when he returned as Secretary of State under President Reagan. He asked if I was still playing tennis, and said he'd love to play, so I worked him into a game the following weekend, and we fell into a routine of Sunday games with more or less the same foursome. We soon added Saturday games and ended up playing every weekend for 6 years, unless he was away on trips. He loved the game so much that he went to great lengths to be there. Once he was engaged in some heavy negotiations having to do with the Middle East, and I assumed he would skip tennis, but he insisted on playing. Wondering how he had gotten out of his meetings, I asked him what he had told Yitzhak Shamir, with whom he had been talking. It didn't surprise me at all to learn that he had said, "I'm going to play tennis." Another time, during a particularly hard match, Bill Webster, then head of the FBI, and I both went for the same ball and collided. I went down so hard I was afraid I'd broken my hip, and a baseball-sized lump quickly formed on my rear end. In the car, George asked if I was all right or if he should take me to an emergency room. "I'm fine," I told him, "but I have this huge bump on my behind. If it weren't for your security men, I'd let you feel it." From driving together to and from our games, our friendship deepened. I must have spent as much time with George as anyone in Washington except Obie, his devoted wife, who died recently. But I never learned anything professional from him in all those hours we spent in his car, though I must say it was apparent that something was wrong during Iran-Contra. He would make oblique remarks and was visibly disturbed and down. Always, George was the soul of discretion and integrity. I don't believe that whom I was or wasn't friends with interfered with our reporting at any of our publications or at the stations. Most of the editors didn't know or care whom I knew. More important, I understood my priorities. In any altercation between the publications and people who were friends, I backed our reporters. Occasionally, if I thought we'd been unfair, I would ask about it, but only in an effort to try to ensure even-handed treatment. If there is a complete conflict of interest, that is, if a friendship develops and the paper has to report something negative that has to do with your friend, you either lose the friend or, if you're lucky, have one who is big enough to forgive and eventually maybe forget. I was moving inexorably toward the end of my seventh decade and was enjoying myself increasingly with each passing year. Up to now, I had never minded getting older. In fact, I hadn't thought about it much. But 1987 was a landmark year, the year I turned 70, and this was a birthday I really did mind. My friend Louvie Pearson had tried to soften the blow by assuring me, 70 is nothing. It's when you hit 75 that you really begin to feel it, and then you feel it increasingly. From my experience, I think she had it just about right, but I didn't know that at the time, and was bothered about being 70. I certainly didn't want to broadcast my age to the world, especially not to the business world, so I was not interested in a party. Polly and Clayton Fritchie and Bob McNamara and I planned a motor trip in and around San Francisco and Yosemite and the Napa Valley, timed deliberately so that I would be gone on my birthday. What I hadn't reckoned on was Lally's persistence. A strong figure in my life, from her very earliest childhood, Lally had combined forces with my three sons to override my real feelings and convince me to go along with the idea of a small party to be given by her and her brothers and their spouses. Reluctantly, I acceded to their wishes, insisting only that it had to be kept to really close friends and family. Lally agreed, but applied her own definition of close friends and family. To my horror and delight in the end, we wound up with over 600 guests in a huge auditorium in Washington. The guests came from all periods of my life and from all over the world. Lally had gone to great trouble to have the huge room decorated with enormous bouquets of beautiful roses coaxed out to full bloom on each table. In an anteroom, there were blown-up pictures of me from every phase of my life, including one of a report card from the Madeira School. Many people had worked on a 4-page mock edition of the Post with a banner headline that read, "Catherine Graham says no to birthday, rejects any hoopla, opts for a quiet evening at home." Don was master of ceremonies, and Lally had arranged for 8 toasts. Art Buchwald got off a great line, "The fantastic turnout tonight. can only be attributed to one thing, fear. President Reagan wound up his words about friendship with, "Here's looking at you, kid," as he raised his champagne glass. Although for me the party was a genuine reflection of how filled with friends was my life, as I got older I naturally began to lose some of these friends, who, as Joe Alsop used to say, had been gathered. During the 1980s, there were many deaths with which I had to deal, beginning with that of my brother Bill, a wonderful human being, sweet, generous, respected in his profession, and much of the time deeply unhappy. Joe Alsop himself was another great loss, one that came toward the end of the decade. In the last several years of his life, he and I had become closer than ever. Perhaps the fact that we were both alone then, he and Susan Mary had separated, strengthened our connection. The traffic and phone calls between our Georgetown houses were almost constant. I not only enjoyed Joe's company, but in some ways depended on it. We needed each other. He was important in my life, and I in his. More than almost anyone I knew, Joe gave pleasure and got pleasure. He once said, "Boredom, emptiness, complacency are the real enemies, and never experience." And he was right. I also lost my dear friend Louvie Pearson, on whom I had counted a great deal for so many years. She was wise, funny, brave, and tolerant. Her devoted friend Malcolm Forbes gave an 80th birthday party for her on his yacht, which was then anchored in New York Harbor. Louvie looked as beautiful as ever, her sculptured, bony face, lanky frame, and long blonde hair seemed never to have changed. But she confided to me that she was getting less able to take care of herself. She was bothered by arthritis in her hands, and feared having to leave her tiny house in Georgetown for a retirement home. 2 years later, just as her health was getting precarious, Louvie died suddenly, on a bridge weekend, exactly the way she would have wanted. Her absence left me very sad, but I couldn't begrudge my friend her merciful death. She died the way anyone would hope to, with all her marbles, and not too painfully, too early, or too late. Because I am at a point in my life where I am losing friends to death with increasing frequency, I have tried to follow Joe Alsop's advice and example to keep developing younger friends. I do that both because I enjoy people of all ages and also to guard against loneliness. Polly, my closest friend for nearly 50 years, remains dear to me, always thoughtful, kind, energetic, funny, and brave. My friendship with Meg has grown and deepened over the years to an extent for which I am infinitely grateful. Liz Hilton, my treasured assistant, who began working with me even before Phil's death, remains my most consistent support. I am still close to my sisters Biss and Ruth, and we talk often and visit each other when we can. By the late 1980s, the Washington Post Company was clearly a success. The stock had skyrocketed during Dick's fine operating years beyond my wildest dreams, reaching $300 per share, amazing to me. We were outperforming our competition in all our divisions. Our quality was higher than ever. We were, as Warren once said, maximizing a tailwind. Beyond Dick's obvious contributions to the success of the company, I think there were several things that helped us achieve what we did. Some of our success had to do with being a family company. At the Star, family involvement got out of hand, too many families for one thing. But I think that family-owned companies bring special qualities to the table and that family members can bring singular attributes to a business enterprise. Possibly, quality may be nourished most easily by a family whose perspective extends beyond the immediate horizon. There are exceptions, to be sure, but family members can provide stability and continuity, and family ownership can prevent takeovers, which is important to smooth operations in this period of disruptive and often ill-considered mergers and acquisitions. Another factor that nudged us along the way was that we never took success for granted. In all our divisions, our businesses competed hard in every sense with our direct competition. We tried never to lose a subscription we had a chance of holding. We worked never to let an inch or a dollar of advertising slip away without a fight. We always anguished over being beaten on a story. and still do. I believe that our concentration on journalistic excellence was a good business approach, as well as a necessary editorial strategy. I think that this was yet another reason for our ultimate success, that we operated under the philosophy, which I have espoused and practiced from the time I took over the company, and which I believe my father and Phil did before me, and Don is doing now, that journalistic excellence and profitability go hand in hand. The reason for putting it that way in the beginning was to try to reassure Wall Street that I cared about profitability. We had spent large sums on building up the editorial products at the Post, Newsweek, and the stations, and had risked a lot on publishing the Pentagon Papers, as we were going public, and the Watergate stories later. I wanted badly to answer the question of why anyone would invest in this company. I had to try to assure Wall Street that I wasn't some mad woman, interested only in risks and editorial issues, but that I was also concerned with how we ran our business. This twin concept had come to me not as a matter of profit margins and business goals, but more as a problem of management. I thought if you did one thing well, focused on a quality product, the results would follow. It's clear that the mathematics of such thinking didn't seem to be with us. After all, in mathematical equations, it is said that only one variable can be maximized at a time. But I think that we helped prove the compatibility of these two goals. Ours was a good record and a good run, and it was finally beginning to be recognized as such by the industry. Warren was kind enough to talk about the company under my direction at a special awards lunch given in 1987 by the Center for Communications in New York, at which I was the guest of honor. He emphasized what he called the less well-reported parts of the story of the company's success. At that time, our record of earnings per share increases was better than that of any of the outstanding companies in our field. The average growth for the top six media companies was 1,550% since 1964. Ours, at 3,150%, was just more than double that. What Warren didn't say, of course, was how much his sage advice had had to do with this record. Warren also joked to the group that he had once found a sheet of paper prominently displayed on my desk that said, "Assets on the left, liabilities on the right." In December 1988, Business Month ran a cover story on the five best-managed companies, which put the Washington Post Company on this short list, with Apple, Merck, Rubbermaid, and Walmart. A few years later, I received Fortune Magazine's Business Hall of Fame Award, a consummate and for me truly gratifying honor. So much of the success for which we were being recognized was directly attributable to Dick. During his tenure, earnings per share grew at an annual compounded rate of 22.5%, and return on equity averaged 26%. Beyond whatever tangible accomplishments could be pointed to or measured, Dick set a high standard of professional management for the company. That's why it was so difficult to think about his ever leaving. But almost from the beginning, he had warned me that he wanted to retire when he was still young enough to teach and to pursue some of his other interests. As his ninth year at the company drew to a close, Dick began to talk about retiring, and at least a year before the company's annual meeting date, in May 1991, he set the date for his departure. I prevailed on him to stay on the board and to remain as president of the International Herald Tribune for 5 years, so that we would maintain our close ties. As 1991 dawned, it was clear to me that Dick's impending departure meant that it was time for me to step down too. I was always concerned lest inertia or the lack of desire to give up lead me to stay too long on the job. I had seen companies hurt or even ruined by an owner-CEO not stepping down at the right time, so I was glad when Dick's move, in a sense, made up my mind for me. I also felt it was fitting that the new team of Don Graham as president and Alan Spoon, then serving as president of Newsweek, but in line to succeed Dick as the company's chief operating officer, move up together. So Dick and I stepped down at the same time from our positions as chief operating and chief executive officers. In our 1991 annual report, Don wrote a lovely, personal, and highly unusual piece to find in an annual report.
"If you're looking for objectivity," he began, "please turn the page."
He retraced my arrival on the scene and my lonely place as the only woman in the Fortune 500 for so many years. He noted financial results and highlighted editorial issues and events since 1963. He recalled my residual self-doubts.
"At a Christmas lunch," Don wrote, "one of her guests asked everyone around the table what they wished they had done earlier in life. Most said they wished they'd been center fielders or movie stars. Kay said she wished she'd gone to Harvard Business School,
which is still true of me today." I was unsure how I would react at the inevitable moment of stepping down, and worried that I would miss the authority and being the ultimate responsible person in the Post company. Fortunately, it hasn't been as difficult as I'd imagined. Perhaps part of this is because I relate well to both Don and Alan, and they are careful to keep me informed. Perhaps, too, it's because it was a gradual departure for me. At the suggestion of several of the company's directors, I retained the title of chairman for 2.5 more years, relinquishing it in September of 1993, when I became chairman of the 3-person executive committee of the company, consisting of Don and Alan and me. Ben's retirement, a few months after mine in 1991, when he reached the age of 70, completed a smooth transition on the editorial side from Ben and me to Len Downey and Don. The predictable negative stories appeared here and there to the effect that Don and Len were lower key, more interested in local news, and more, well, boring. This was the same kind of story that had appeared about me when I was new. People are judgmental about young managers and like to compare them unfavorably with their predecessors. But Len had gradually taken over running the news side of the paper from Ben in the preceding 5 years, as Don had taken over the paper and some of what I did at the company. He'd already been publisher for more than 12 years when he became president, and later chairman. Ben had indeed, as we said in our annual report that year, redefined the Post for a generation of Washingtonians. His retirement was a moving event, or series of events, I should say. It was all done as Ben did everything, with great style. Just before he walked out of the newsroom on August 31st, there was to be a small farewell cake and champagne party for him. It turned into a mass uprising, with many spontaneous speeches and stories told about the legendary Ben, stories about people whose lives he had touched, so many uniquely Ben incidents, not all of them printable. No one wanted to leave. After 3 hours, Don remarked that one of the reporters had brought her new baby with her that day, and the baby was about to celebrate her 3rd birthday. On that note, Ben walked out of the newsroom and out of the building, but certainly not out of the life of the Post. He remains vice president at large, a title at which he always grins, with an office on the Post's executive floor. His energy and charm are undiminished. He is busy and happy and productive, and has written a fascinating and well-received memoir, a book in which we hear his true voice, the best kind of book. Without the major responsibilities that went along with my title, I had to try to reshape my life, to give it some new form that would serve not merely to fill my days, but to give some real meaning to what my friend Louvi used to call the last lap. It's hard for people who leave power to relinquish certain enjoyable things, the inside seat, the privileged conversations, the ultimate responsibility, and the many other perquisites that go along with the kind of job I had had for so long. Admittedly, many of us get spoiled by all of the benefits of our jobs. I certainly did. But I also believe it's healthy to have to return to a more normal life. There are advantages to private pleasures, probably more so if you have managed to maintain some balance during your years at the top, which I tried to do. But of course I am still spoiled in many ways, certainly by being able to pursue the myriad interests in my life and by having a staff both in the office and at home to support me in all that I do. In configuring a new way of life, I tried to understand what I needed to retain from my old one. I knew it was important to keep active physically and mentally. I have returned to playing bridge, which I love,
and hope to take up golf and maybe even continue tennis. Most important, though, is to keep working. I knew that I essentially never wanted not to work. To me, working is a form of sustenance, like food or water, and nearly as essential. Perhaps this was a direct genetic inheritance from my parents. I knew, too, that though I would still be involved with the company on a part-time basis, I needed something else. Reorganizing my working life meant finding a new kind of balance. I focused initially on continuing to do some things for the company and becoming more involved in education and writing these memoirs. Why dare to write a book? What makes any of us think that someone else would be interested in stories from our own past? For me, there was a mixture of motives. I had been thinking about my parents, who, with their drive, discipline, eccentricity, and wealth, might be of interest even to non-family people. Also, I felt that Phil's story had not been told. His brains, ability, and charm were legendary among his friends, but no one had written fully about him and his accomplishments, as well as about his devastation by his largely untreated manic depression. Partly, I wanted to look at my own life, because my personal history contains elements that were both unexpected and unrepeatable. I recognize the inherent danger of being self-serving and have tried to retain as much detachment as possible, but I wanted to tell what happened just as I saw it. And in the process, I hope to arrive at some understanding of how people are formed by the way they grow up and further molded by the way they spend their days. It is ironic that I became so intensely interested in education, which took up so much of my mother's later life. Possibly this was another of her legacies to me. I believe, as she did, that education is not only the most important societal problem, but the most interesting. Of course, there are countless numbers of education projects being implemented and enormous sums being spent across the country, but I wanted to do something simple and direct. Perhaps make life a little better for a few children without trying to prove anything or getting encumbered in a large bureaucracy. Along with a very able, inspiring, and determined younger partner, Terry Golden, I have helped launch an early childhood education project in the Anacostia section of Washington, D.C. Though the project as a whole has grown larger than I had envisioned, it concentrates on two housing projects, Frederick Douglass Community Homes and Stanton Dwellings, and aims at helping mostly single and unemployed parents be involved in the education of their children. We have raised enough money to help create a community service center for parents with a small daycare unit for up to 15 infants and a new school for 100 Head Start children from the ages of 2 to 4. Our hope is that this is a public-private endeavor that can be replicated in other areas of the district as well as elsewhere. I anticipate continuing to work on education issues when this project ends. Fulfilling work, writing, keeping up with my old friends, adding new ones, these are the things I concentrate on now, as well as relating to my children and their families. My children remain remarkably close, even when they are having differences with each other or with me. I have not chronicled their adult lives so as not to intrude on their privacy, but I feel grateful to have been able to spend so much time with each of them. Lally published 2 books and then became a newspaper and magazine journalist, writing a good deal for the Los Angeles Times, New York Magazine, and Parade. The Post began regularly printing a column by her in 1991, and I take enormous pride in the quality of her writing and admire how hard she works at it. She has traveled the world and interviewed more leaders than I ever did. Her daughters, Catherine and Pamela, are well launched on their own professional careers. My son, Bill, after working as a lawyer at Williams & Connolly and at the Los Angeles Public Defender's Office and teaching law at UCLA, started an investment partnership. As tough a critic as Warren has admired his approach and work, at which Bill has demonstrably succeeded. At the same time, he is one of the most devoted parents I know. Of all my children, it is Bill who most loves the vineyard. He has built a house next door to mine there, which means that I am able to see him and his teenage children, Edward and Alice, regularly. Steve has lived in New York City all his adult life, and after working for Mike Nichols and Lewis Allen in the theater, he became a producer of plays, producing works by Sam Shepard, Athol Fugard, E.R. Gurney, and other contemporary playwrights. He also founded the New York Theater Workshop, a nonprofit group devoted to producing plays by little-known American writers. The workshop produced early plays by John Guare, among others, and staged the original production of Rent, a current Broadway hit and Tony winner. Steve then became a doctoral candidate in English at Columbia University and is now publisher of the Echo Press, one of America's best literary presses. In 1996, Rent and a Poet, published by Echo, Jory Graham, formerly married to Billy, won Pulitzer Prizes, giving Steve two in a year when the Post had none. Steve's wife, Kathy, an illustrator, is also involved in community work in New York. I am lucky to have Don and Mary in Washington. They have brought up four children, Liza, Laura, Will, and Molly, who now range in age from 24 to 14. Mary gave up being a lawyer after practicing for some years and devotes herself to writing, being involved with the children, and her own community interests. It is my family and the engrossing pleasures I've mentioned that help me face the unavoidable problems of age and the inevitable loss of friends. I will be publishing this book when I am 79. I've been fortunate in lifestyle, in health, and in having so many interests, but old age is no barrel of laughs. Even if you are generally healthy, there are things, your heart, atrial fibrillation, your hips, arthritis, general slowing down mentally and physically, that make denial of aging an impossibility. People begin to take your arm, ask if you want an elevator, and generally treat you like a relic. Though they have nothing but the best and most solicitous of motives, it's hard not to feel condescended to. At the same time, there are positive aspects to being old. Worry, if not gone altogether, no longer haunts you in the middle of the night, and you are free, or freer, to turn down the things that bore you and spend time on matters and with people you enjoy. I am grateful to be able to go on working and to like my new life so well that I don't miss the old one. It's dangerous when you are older to start living in the past. Now that it's out of my system, I intend to live in the present, looking forward to the future. Acknowledgements. From the start, I very much wanted to write this book myself, although I realized I wasn't a real professional. I well remember the columnist Walter Lippmann once telling me how hard it was, even for him who wrote all the time, to get back into writing after a hiatus of only a few weeks. That thought kept recurring when I considered whether or not to write on my own rather than with a co-author. But because I wanted this to be a personal story, I knew I had to tell it myself. If I've succeeded at all, it is due to two people, my researcher, Evelyn Small, and my editor, Robert Gottlieb. Ev came from the Washington Post Company, where she was in corporate communications, producing an internal newsletter and doing research for speeches, including mine. She worked for several years at organizing my papers in such a way that we could together take a look back. As time passed, her role grew in importance. She knew as much about my life as I did. She took the words I wrote and shaped them, reminding me of important details, tactfully eliminating others, adding things from the research that I'd overlooked. This book could not have happened without Ev. For 4 years, she was ably assisted by Todd Mendeloff. Only a small percentage of the stories Ev unearthed and brought to light again could find their way into the book itself, which was also true for the more than 250 interviews we conducted with people ranging from childhood classmates and lifelong friends to many of those who were involved with the Pentagon Papers, Watergate, or the Washington Post Company. But they all added to my perspective. Bob Gottlieb, whom I first talked with about a book in 1978, became my editor when he returned to Knopf from The New Yorker. He has masterfully edited my copy with meticulous care and a ruthless eye for repetition, tediousness, and sequence. Quite often I found, "We don't need this," written in the margins. Even when he axed a story I might have particularly liked, always in the interest of space, according to Bob, there were few squeals of protest from me. I may have grieved for the fallen pages, but he, Ev, and I always had the same goal in mind. And on those occasions when I thought something essential lay on the floor, Bob generously acceded to my pleading. My friend Meg Greenfield, editorial page editor of The Post and Newsweek columnist, whose editing skills and advice have been sought out by me, and on whom I have relied for much of my professional life, also read and commented on the manuscript. Meg's mind and mine work in similar ways, as do our judgments about people and situations, about what is funny and what is intolerable. Our friendship has endured and grown almost from the moment of her arrival at the Post. Five other important people also read and commented on the manuscript and were exceedingly helpful. My daughter, Lally, my sons, Don, Bill, and Steve, and my friend Warren Buffett. This project has renewed my appreciation for the value of archival material. I have spent innumerable hours poring over old letters and memos from and between my parents, my husband, and myself, as well as communications involving Post and Newsweek executives and editors. I am thankful that we all wrote letters in those days. For saving much of this material and organizing it originally, I must acknowledge the late and incomparable Charlie Paradise, secretary and assistant to my father, to Phil, and then to me for some years. Charlie used to answer the phone by singing out, "Paradise!" My thanks go also to all of those from whose letters I quote. I am indebted to Chalmers Roberts, whose living history of the Post, the Washington Post, the first 100 years, Houghton Mifflin Company, 1977, has been a constant source of information, and to Merlo Pusey for his biography of my father, Eugene Meyer, Alfred A. Knopf, 1974. Both books informed our research and my thinking. In my office, I am grateful to Liz Hilton for her devoted and patient work over 33 years, including help on the book. She has not only run my office, keeping all my papers and my business and social calendars, but she has managed my houses as well. In many ways, she has been my alter ego. For the last 2 years, I have also been greatly helped by my assistant Barry Tonoff. I have worked closely for 15 years with Guyon Chip Knight, Vice President for Corporate Communications at the Washington Post Company, whose extraordinary talents have crafted all my public utterances. In addition, I want to thank the people in the Post's News Research Center, on whom we relied time and again for their ever-ready and always accurate information. I also want to thank the many people at Knopf who have helped me with this book: Sonny Mehta, Jane Friedman, Bill Lovard, and Paul Bogards, for their interest and support; Carol Carson, Virginia Tan, Cassandra Pappas, and Tracy Cabanis, for their talented design and production; and Kathy Horrigan, Layla Aker, Karen Moogler, Amy Scheib, and Ken Schneider, for their editorial assistance. Of course, I am responsible for the final contents of the book. I have tried to be frank and honest, while honoring privacy, particularly that of my children, who are naturally more important to me than I can describe here, and have achieved so much in their own lives. They, too, were deeply and permanently affected by all that happened. My two surviving sisters, Elizabeth Lorentz and Ruth Epstein, have also been involved, helpful, and interested, sharing with me their own memories and judgments. My late brother, Bill, Eugene Meyer III, was always supportive during his lifetime, and I am eternally grateful for that, although he died before I began the book. With all of my trepidations about writing, and with all of the complications inherent in looking back over a long and full life, writing this book has been a rigorous and absorbing exercise, one that I've enjoyed immensely. Throughout the book, I hope I've given credit where credit is due, and haven't neglected those to whom I owe so much. Necessarily, many names have been left out, but they are in my head and in my heart. This is Carrington MacDuffie. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Personal History by Catherine Graham. This program was directed by Lisa Bainey, executive producer Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 1997 by Catherine Graham. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.